Good morning, everyone. Before we start, can I just ask people to silence their cell or mobile phones for the duration of the press conference? I'm Craig McClure. I'm the Executive Director of the International AIDS Society, and I welcome you all here today. I'd like to, on behalf of the IS and our local partner, the Australasian Society for HIV Medicine, ASHAM, just like to say how thrilled we are about the representation of the media at this conference, the 6,500 participants at the conference, and just like to say what an exciting first plenary session we had today. Also want to thank you all for your attention to the Sydney Declaration that was issued by IAS and ASHAM in advance of this conference and is in the Lancet. We're all becoming increasingly aware that the only way we can continue to scale up treatment access to universal access and then to sustain it globally is if we strengthen health systems. And we can only strengthen health systems if we strengthen the human capacity in countries, we strengthen the infrastructure in countries, and strengthen the research capacity in countries. If we don't understand better what we're doing now so that we can improve upon it and do better in the future, there is no chance, I think, to achieve and sustain universal access to HIV care. And I think Deborah Work-Zudi illustrated that so eloquently in her presentation this morning. So without further ado, I'd like to begin by introducing Dr. Zudi, who is the director of the Global HIV/AIDS Program for the World Bank. Deborah Work?
Thank you. I'll be very brief and I'll let you ask the questions. I think the most important thing during this conference is to bring back the research culture which we have lost in the South. I am a product of a North-South partnership. When I was working in Ethiopia, there was a North-South organization called AIDS and Reproductive Health Network, based in Harvard. And what the northern scientists used to do is to help us write research proposals, get funding, we collaborate, and we did some of the research which actually informed the programs in rollout of prevention and care in the early 80s. This is at the beginning of the epidemic. Over the years, we have concentrated more in service delivery in the South, and the research culture has died. That is why I'm personally excited about the Sydney Declaration, which hopefully will bring back the research culture to the South and strengthen the North-South and South-South collaboration, which is mutually beneficial to both. Thank you.
Our second plenary speaker this morning was Dr. Michael Lederman, who is the Scott R. Inclee Professor of Medicine and Professor of Pathology, Molecular Biology, Microbiology, and Biomedical Ethics at Case Western Reserve University. Dr. Lederman's plenary remarks focused on immune activation in HIV disease, and I'd like to turn to him now.
Thanks, Craig. So it's kind of, I won't say much, but it's remarkable that 26 years into the HIV epidemic, we don't really know how HIV causes AIDS. There's surely no question that it does. I mean, without HIV, there is no AIDS. But the precise mechanisms whereby this happens are really poorly understood. And why is this important? Well, it's important to know for its own sake, of course. I mean, that's what we do. But it's also important because if we can learn exactly how HIV causes immune deficiency, then we might even be able to open up new avenues of treatment, that is to interfere with the downstream pathways that drive immune deficiency in the setting of HIV replication. And I think this is an underexplored area that needs some more work. So there is evidence and growing evidence, and actually the first evidence of this was in 1981 with the first publication or recognition of AIDS, that immune activation is a characteristic of untreated HIV infection. And now there's evidence that immune activation is a better predictor of disease progression than the magnitude of viral replication, and that immune activation actually mediates a large part of the turnover of T cells, CD4 positive T helper cells, that ultimately are depleted from circulation and ultimately result in the sustained and broad immune deficiency that we define as AIDS. So I think that'll do it.
Thank you. I'd like to turn to our third plenary speaker from this morning, who is Dr. Brian Gazzard, consultant physician and research director for the Department of HIV and genitourinary medicine at Chelsea Westminster Hospital and the founder and chairperson of the British HIV Association. Dr. Gazzard spoke this morning on HIV and aging. Brian?
I was talking about the fact that people who are lucky enough to be given antiretroviral therapy will live decades as a result. And the real issue now facing many of them is, will they die prematurely of some other condition, having lived for decades? And so we were discussing whether people will die early of atheroma, of neoplasia, of dementia. One of the slightly irritating things, I suppose, as a clinician, is you sit there and this guy who 10 years ago would have been dead comes in and says, but I'm very upset about my cholesterol, which is 5.3, and you swallow hard and, you know, you don't say, look, mate, you know, you say, yes, we'll do our best to deal with that for you as well, and I think that's, after the momentary irritation is over, you're actually, isn't that impressive that people now live such normal lives that they start to worry about the small things again? I'm quite a young man, but I've never had my cholesterol done, and I aren't about to start now, thank you very much, nor have I ever had my blood pressure measured, so, but I'm very happy to measure the patient's blood pressure and measure their cholesterol as often as they want it measured.
Thank you, Brian. I think we'll open it up for questions. Just a couple of guidelines. When you are selected to speak, if you could just state your name and the organization that you're working from, and be sure to use the microphone because the session is being recorded. Andrea.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Okay, great. Good morning. My name is Andrea Downer. I'm a journalist from Jamaica representing the Gleaner Company. Being from a developing country, I'm very excited about the new focus that is being encouraged on increased research that will guide the particular treatment regimens in developed countries that are for persons from developing countries with their particular needs and issues. However, I'm curious to find out, how will we move forward in terms of logistics? How will this new mandate become operational? Because, for example, in one country, 10% of their funding is going to be much more, or it will be less in another country. And with so many different countries and so many different people and programs involved, how will we ensure that people actually do this? Accountability. What is the way forward after the discussions and debates at this conference? Thank you.
Deborah, what do you want to?
Sure, let me have a go. How will we move forward? I see three partners in this who could move this forward. Number one, donor governments and donor countries. As you know, most donors have a tie in the money that is going to countries. And if they include part of that money should go to research for three reasons. Research builds capacity. Research creates ownership by the countries. If researchers in country do and find the evidence to fight this epidemic and roll out treatment, it's much more than reading about some successful program which was done somewhere else. Research is also an advocacy tool. We should all be worried that this money which is coming into HIV/AIDS is not going to continue the way it's coming now. So we need research to show that what we are doing is supported by evidence from research and it is sustainable. So for these three reasons, it is in the interest of the donor governments and the donor agencies to increase research and to fund research as part of the treatment rollout which they are putting in place. And it is a tremendous amount of resources, and I think it is a win-win situation. The second partners in these are the countries themselves. They could put in their own resources. They could improve the conditions in country for researchers and health professionals to do research. Because it is, as you heard from my plenary talk, it's really not a luxury for a developing country scientist to do research on the site. Because there are a number of things which they need for survival, which they have to fulfill in the time that they would be engaged in research. And this can be something which the countries themselves could take upon themselves to make it, to create an enabling environment for developing country researchers to do research. The third part are the academic institutions. We have wonderful relationships, as I showed on my talk, which have, these are a co-equal relationship. It's not that the northern scientists are donating something to the southern scientists. It's a mutual relationship. It's unfortunate, but the poor countries have the disease and the problem, and the rich countries have the technology and the funding. So if these synergize, then we would be able to move this forward. The last but not least is pharmaceutical companies. They need to be involved in developing research in the developing world. Some of them do, as you have seen the example of Botswana, but we need much more involvement. So if all these parties come together and realize that the money which is going to be put in research is not taking away money from treatment. Because if we don't do treatment properly, we will pay more when we find out that we've been doing it wrong.
Can I just add, Andrea, one point to your question about what next? I mean, advocacy has always driven the response to HIV and AIDS, advocacy at all levels. This conference and other conferences like it are an opportunity for people across different stakeholders to talk about this issue, whether it's activists and community advocates, researchers, UN agencies, governments, donor and recipient governments. So opportunities like this conference provide for people to talk about the declarations, to start to think about how could we move to implementing a more coordinated approach between delivery of services and health economics research, operational research, clinical research. Deborah work outlined, and actually the Sydney Declaration does state that there are already provisions in many of the donor bodies, including the Global Fund for Operations Research and PEPFAR for evaluation and within the bank, to allow for the research community to participate in the country-driven multi-stakeholder planning and oversight bodies, such as the country coordinating mechanisms, to ensure that research is part of service delivery. But they're not engaged at the moment. Most CCMs in countries simply don't have the involvement of the research community. So if we can stimulate that by talking about it at this conference and going back to our workplaces, talking amongst our colleagues, beginning to think how we could begin to implement it, then that would be the first step. Another question.
Hi, I'm Mariah Foley from the Associated Press. My question is about the rollout of antiretroviral therapies. Recent statistics have shown that it's still well short of meeting the UN's goal of universal access by 2010. I'm wondering if you might be able to expand on what some of the specific challenges have been in the rollout of these drugs.
I think it's back to you, Deborah. Okay.
Thank you. The challenge, primarily when we started rolling out treatment, as I stated, frankly, many people didn't think that treatment would be possible in resource-poor settings. We owe it to the Paul Farmers of this world who showed in Haiti and David Kotze in Kilileshwa, South Africa, to show that indeed this treatment can be rolled out in resource-poor settings. That's how we began. We began on a negative sense in a way that it is not going to work. Once we proved that it does indeed work, and this unfounded fear that by rolling out treatment in resource-poor settings, we will create resistance problem for the world, I think that is behind us. But we did lose a lot of traction while we were trying to prove this. Now the world has come to grips with it, and treatment rollout is being done synergistically by those who fund programs and by the countries themselves who have declared universal access for treatment. It is surprising that many poor countries in the developing world have stood up to the occasion and said, we will try to provide universal access to treatment to the population. However, the magnitude of the problem is huge. But to come from 300,000 people in 2003 to 2 million people on treatment, I think everybody should take that as an achievement, which many people believed it was going to be impossible only a few years ago. The aim now is to increase that much more. We have excellent organizations such as the Global Fund, and the northern governments are stepping up to the commitments which they entered at the different G8 and different fora. What is missing and what we need to do to make sure that we succeed is, as the resources for treatment are being provided simultaneously, I think it was Michelle Kazatchkin yesterday who alluded to it, simultaneously we need to build capacity, we need to encourage research and give incentives to the service providers in these developing countries so that they would not only serve the people who need them, but they would also be keeping up with the science and help the rolling out. I think we are in the right direction. Many of the agencies that are working on HIV/AIDS are committed to the universal access, but we need research to show that these monies are being used effectively, efficiently, and most of all, we will be building health systems which have been dilapidated way before HIV/AIDS and use the opportunity that this epidemic brings so that we can not only roll out treatment for HIV/AIDS, but we would deal with the other diseases which are killing people in developing countries.
I'm Sheridan from New Tongue Dynasty Television. We're a bilingual English-Chinese television station. And I was reading only in February this year, about a doctor who, Dr. Gao Yaojie, who is actually doing a lot of research and raising awareness in China about the AIDS problem that they have there. But trying to look myself, I couldn't find a lot of information. And in the G8 summit recently, there was an article talking about China as being one of the countries where there's not a lot of access to research. And so my question would be to, she's being actually put under house arrest in Washington. They wanted to give her an award for the efforts that she's put in. And the Communist Party has actually put her under house arrest to not be able to leave and network. So this is a real, you said today, Deborah, work about the political limitations. So how is it we can break through so that there's an open sharing between all these countries? Thanks.
Michael, do you want to have a go at that one?
That's a bit out of my ken. Science is so dependent upon the ability to share and the willingness of people to talk about what they do and to correct the things that they might have done wrong with future work. I'm not familiar with the story of this woman. I know that there is a strong scientific infrastructure in the People's Republic of China, and there are a number of universities, at least a big one in Beijing, that is engaged in some very, very high-level cutting-edge research. And I think one of the good things about that is that as the culture of science and research expands, then things such as the story that you describe are going to become harder and harder to tolerate in that country. Brian, thank you for rescuing me. I'm sure you have something.
No, it's only that I go to China either once or twice a year. I have been doing for 10 years. We have a charity that is there to raise awareness. And my view would be there's been a tremendous sea change in China in the last 2 or 3 years, with a much greater willingness to talk about the numbers were infected, much greater willingness to talk about men having sex with men as an origin of infection. And I think that the Chinese government is changing very rapidly. I think there are problems, and clearly the problems relate to officials at different levels who are more resistant than others, and so you may well find this poor lady's been imprisoned by a federal authority somewhere down in the country who aren't very responsive to central government. And I think that will change. China's changing unbelievably quickly, is itself aware of the normative, its problem. Itself announced recently that at least 1 million people were HIV infected in China. And I think many good things will come out of that country over the next few years. And certainly, as Mike says, there's a very strong research infrastructure there. Cheapest place to buy IL-2 anywhere in the world is in China, where they make it for Tom's Hapenny, a vial. I mean, they're an amazingly inventive people.
And just to echo those comments from the IS perspective, it's absolutely true that in the last couple of years, China has dramatically dramatically increased its commitment to addressing AIDS in all of the ways that you outlined, Brian. But I think what we need to recognize, what we all recognize at the IS, is that all the scientific interventions, all the biomedical interventions at our disposal for treatment or prevention, all of the research capacity that's maybe at China's disposal, that we need the protection of human rights to ensure that treatment and prevention is scaled up properly. We've been working with China in terms of the potential to host a future international AIDS conference at some point in the next few years. One of the stumbling blocks there is that currently China does not allow the short-term entry of people living with HIV and AIDS, but fortunately, that law is currently under review by the government, which is another sign, I think, that things are changing in China. Take another question.
Sophie Scott from ABC Television. There's some stories in the paper today reported from the address from Michelle Kachikine. I apologize if I mispronounce his name, where they're saying that AIDS is no longer a death sentence and that the world is on the cusp of beating HIV. And I really just wanted to get reaction from some of the panel to that statement, whether you thought that was true, and if so, just to elaborate on whether that is the case.
So, I think Michelle is right. I'm almost as old as Brian, and I've been doing HIV care since 1983. And in those days, I would regularly see my patients die. Life expectancy was short. I wouldn't even tell my patients who enjoyed cigarettes to stop smoking, because it didn't seem to make a lot of sense if we were talking about survival in terms of months and a few years. But now we're talking about a fairly robust life expectancy. The predictions aren't quite the same as normal. And as Brian elegantly pointed out in his talk, we have to be on the lookout for things that we didn't think were going to be complications of HIV infection and AIDS. So the future is a little uncertain, but it's so bright compared to what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago.
I mean, to be honest, I don't agree at all. I think the HIV epidemic is essentially uncontrolled. It's uncontrolled in Africa. It's uncontrolled completely in Asia, really, at the moment. The statistics that were shown this morning for India and parts of Southeast Asia are, I think, a very real indictment of what's likely to be ahead of us. And I think that you can foresee a world if you look at 100,000 years, you can foresee a world where the only survivors will be Delta 32 deleted CCR5 individuals who will marry together and produce homozygous. I think that the scale of the endeavor to actually beat this epidemic, nobody has started to really conceive of yet. And I feel very powerfully that's because we all sit in an environment where it doesn't seem to matter very much, which is nothing could be further from the truth. It's going to affect all humanity in due course. And I'm always very impressed by the statistic that if everybody in the Western world went to the cinema once less a year, put that £10 to the global AIDS fund, that would transform not only HIV care for the rest of the world, but actually also general health care as well. But I don't think we're doing it. I mean, that's what, I think that the message going out from this conference that, in fact, we're on the cusp of you know, dramatic development that we're going to beat AIDS would be a disaster. One, because it's untrue, and two, because I think it sends the very wrong message. But unless we have more humanity for our fellow man and more self-interest, in a sense, as well, that we will not be immune. America will not remain immune from an epidemic which decimates the rest of the world. We will not succeed at all. So I'm rather negative, but sorry.
So, I mean, what I hear from the panel really is, or how I interpret both of your comments is that we could go in either direction, that we're at a point in time where there are more resources, certainly for HIV and AIDS than there were before, but nowhere near enough, and nowhere near enough commitment. There is a possibility that we could overcome this disease, which is what I heard from you, Mike. And the sense this conference wants to give is that the science is exciting, the resources have increased, programming has increased, and we're at a point where we could begin the end of the epidemic, or we could begin to go down a very negative track where people assume that there are enough resources now and that the problem is over, and it certainly isn't. Can we take another question?
My name is Abdul Basti Ashaba. I'm a journalist from United Arab Emirates. I work with the Emirates Evening Post newspaper. I come from a country with some of the lowest rates of HIV, but my question is mainly directed to Ms. De Broek. I want to find out, I know one of the roles of the World Bank HIV program is to ensure that people living with HIV/AIDS live a full life and also help countries build strong preventive mechanisms. So I would like to know, how do you reconcile a situation whereby a country denies the entrance of people into it because they are HIV positive, and yet these people feel like working in those countries? For example, in UAE, one of the conditions for one to become a resident is that you have to be HIV negative. So lots of people can't come and work there. So I would like to know, I mean, how do you reconcile two situations where people want to live, if people living with HIV/AIDS want to live a full life, and yet some countries, as a preventive mechanism, are blocking them into coming there?
I think there are two issues here. One is, how does the World Bank work? And the other one is, what countries do. The World Bank has no jurisdiction over what countries do within their own countries. I think the issue of allowing people in or out in the AIDS era should be a global concern. This is a global community. This is a global epidemic. It's not something that one would leave to any agency or institution. This is not unique for those of us who have been working on this epidemic since the early 1980s. Countries had different reactions to how they were going to deal with people with HIV infections. That is why we have organizations such as the IAS. I remember the Amsterdam conference was not held where it was supposed to be held for exactly the same reason. How do we work? We are completely demand-driven. The countries come to us and ask for our support. They come with their programs. We look at their programs. We give them technical advice, and the program continues. It is a very difficult issue to deal with, and in my time within the World Bank, I didn't have to deal with such an issue, because the countries that come to the bank have already realized the gravity of this problem, and they come with the need to have prevention, care, and treatment accessible to their people. So our task has been made very easy. But the bank does not interfere with how countries deal with or without this problem. We are part of the international community, and we believe in the rights of human beings, in the rights of people living with HIV/AIDS having access just like anybody else.
think take another question.
Tamara McLean, Australian Associated Press. This is a question for Brian. I just wonder if you might be able to, talking to your address earlier, canvass the complications of people living longer with HIV. And does this mean in countries like Australia we have a population that is increasingly vulnerable to disease as they live longer and longer with the condition?
Yes, I mean, I think that one shouldn't overestimate the problem. I mean, compared with some of the problems that we've been discussing this morning, it's not the biggest problem in the world. I doubt that there are going to be, you know, millions of demented Australians living in Byers Rock by the year 2010. I think it's more likely to be an issue. Does heart contribute to that problem, or does it protect from it, and are there different heart regimes which would protect from it more effectively? I think those are the sort of issues, and for the individuals themselves, clearly there is an issue around that they may not have a normal lifespan, although rather simplistically I often say to people, you'll die in your bed of old age. I think that's not, it may be true that they die of old age, but not at their biological old age. I think it doesn't have enormous implications for healthcare systems. I mean, I think it's very important to emphasize that the cheapest way of saving a year of life for any chronic disease is HIV treatment. Right? So for £7,000, you save a year of life, which is often a young, productive individual who can work, pay taxes, etc. So anybody who believes that HIV care is expensive doesn't look at coronary artery bypass surgery, where the equivalent figure is £50,000 a year, or renal dialysis. So I think HIV provision of HIV care is very cheap, but clearly that does result in a population that grows who are all HIV positive. And the cumulative costs get bigger. But I don't think it's going, I don't see that in any developed country the burden of health care will be so enormous that that it was unsustainable.
Tamar.
South African newspaper called Business Day. It's kind of a linked question to you, Brian. With the growing numbers of people on treatment in the developing world, there's obviously going to be a growing cohort of older patients on ARVs. And I just wondered whether there were, firstly, any specific issues perhaps relating to populations in the developing world regarding aging and HIV, and linked to that, whether there was any recent research that was based on older cohorts in the developing world.
I think the answer to the second question is no. The one thing I'm an expert on this week is Googling aging and HIV and the millions of articles that come out, not one from the developing world. I mean, I think there will be specific problems. I think if you look, say, at the cardiovascular illness rates in Asia, they are very high. They're at the genetic predisposition to cancer, to cardiovascular disease seems to be very high, and so therefore the interaction between that and HIV may be quite a potent force. And similarly, I suppose that the acquisition of other oncogenic viruses in Africa, EBV, etc., may yield a very wide range of cancers which will be very poorly managed, but not even thought about. So head and neck cancer, even in a very highly sophisticated country like South Africa, is probably not very well managed in terms of care, a very complicated set of care, and some very expensive new drugs available for care of those things. Clearly, compared with the devastating problem of lack of access and mortality because of no treatment, these aging issues are a small issue, but will be of some growing importance.
You talked about the divide between the North and South and the need to encourage research in the South. What can you expand on the benefits to those poor countries when the technology and the health infrastructures are far greater in the richer countries? Wouldn't it be better to put your resources into those richer countries to develop the new treatments? What are the benefits to the poorer countries in encouraging that research?
A number of things. The first one is delivery of services. You can have wonderful drugs developed in the north, and if one doesn't know how to administer them, when to administer them, taking into consideration the mosaic of opportunistic infections in the developing world, those drugs which are expensive and which where a lot of resources went into their development will not be working in these resource poor settings. That's one reason. The second one, and we have a number of examples, it's not only HIV/AIDS. It's always successful when the people who are supposed to administer treatment are knowledgeable about the drug itself, its interaction, and how they are going to administer it. This not only gives them the best knowledge to treat their patients, it is also in and of itself an incentive for. I'll give you my own personal example. I was trained as a clinical immunologist in London, and part of the reason why I ended up in program management was it was such an uphill battle to do research in a place where, just like I showed in my presentation, where the diagnostic kits, which would be sent to me from a Northern University or a pharmaceutical company, would be sitting in the dock, and I would spend hours and days to get it out. By the time I get it out, some of it has expired. And this is extremely frustrating for a scientist in a developing country who is who has the same concerns and the same requirements as a scientist in the north to advance what they are trained in. The last point is capacity. For how long are we going to depend on evidence and research that's done in the north without developing the south? It's not only for HIV/AIDS, it's for all kinds of epidemics. How do you encourage capacity building to these developing country scientists and health professionals to deal with their epidemics if you continue the research to be done on the north and handing it to them and say, administer this? There is no ownership. There's no incentive. There's no growth. So that's on the side of the south. On the north, if you look into clinical trials, including vaccine development, the part of the biggest problem to do research is the population doesn't exist in the north. So the research environment that you need to develop your drug or your microbicide or your vaccine happens in the south. And I think it's only logical that there is a co-equal relationship when two different parties hold two pieces of something where half of it doesn't make any sense anywhere, but the whole is for the benefit of both the north and the south.
I think one of the things you outlined so clearly today, Deborah Work, was that research means so much more than clinical research. You talked about operations research, social research to understand better the communities most vulnerable and affected by HIV, cost-effectiveness research. The whole gamut of research and research capacity is the issue you were really addressing.
Good morning. This is Jaswinder Sehgal from India, representing Voice of America Hindi Service. We are talking a lot about vaccines. We are talking a lot about ARV medicines. In my area, the people are very much worried about opportunistic infection. They don't know that whether they are dying of AIDS or HIV. They know that they are dying due to opportunistic infection, and they don't have medicine for them.
Brian or Michael, do you want to?
I don't spend much time at home. I go to India every year as well. I think that the point of treating opportunistic infection, if you don't treat the underlying HIV disease, is limited. So if you treat somebody with cryptococcal meningitis, they'll be dead within a year of recurrent cryptococcal meningitis. So the provision of antiretrovirals, which of course India has been wonderful, has produced more cheaper antiretrovirals than any other nation. That's what's crucial. The opportunistic infections will then go away. That's not to say that people with opportunistic infections shouldn't be treated, but it is to say that it would be foolhardy to say the only problem in India is provision of fluconazole, which anyway Abbott in their bounty give away free, not Abbott, Pfizer. Abbott can't give any. Oh, sorry, that's a different press conference. I'm sorry. That was off the record.
I don't think so.
So I think that, and you're right, India is very slow to recognize the enormity of the problem that they have.
I think we have time for one final question, if there is one. No one who hasn't asked a question. Okay, go ahead.
Sophie from ABC Television. Just on the issue of research into looking at circumcision as a way of preventing the transmission of HIV, would any of the panel like to comment on some of the research that's looking at that?
The data is overwhelming that it does. The data is not overwhelming about two important aspects of that. One, whether that's true for gay males. There is some data that men who have sex with men have a reduced incidence of their circumcised, but the data's not as clear-cut. Secondly, it's not as clear-cut that women are protected from circumcised men, although that again may be true, and one of the studies is actually examining that, but the data isn't out yet. Clearly, the unknowns are how long that protection will last, whether it would lead to disinhibition. There's no data that it has done at the moment, but and how practical it would be to implement. Having said all that, I actually personally think that the relative risk reduction of 60%, which is actually probably in excess of what most vaccines are suggested to be used, is absolutely enormous, and really the logistic effort to introduce circumcision would probably be better than for an untried technology. I'll say that deliberately because Mike's sitting here, of microbicides, may be very important but untried. We at least have a treatment that really does, a prevention that really does have an enormous impact. Absolutely. But that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, the real problem, we've known for 50 years now that if every child in an African village was given levamisole as a dewormer once a year, the IQ would be 20 points better. We've known that for 50 years, but nobody does it. So that's what we were talking about this morning, operational research. Why has nobody done that? You know, they've done the interesting bit, but the follow-through is very difficult.
Just to add on circumcision, I don't think we're likely to see any more clinical trials, at least in terms of heterosexual transmission from women to men, because there have been three trials now. The second and the third were actually stopped ultimately because the results were so positive. The first phase three trial, the results were actually presented at our last conference 2 years ago in Rio, and there's been observational data in HIV and AIDS related to the positive impact of circumcision for many, many years. So I think what's happening now in terms of circumcision is many countries are looking at how to begin to scale up circumcision. About 30%, I think, of people worldwide are circumcised anyway, either at birth or as part of a rite of passage into adulthood. So the key issue now will be looking at effectiveness in the field as circumcision is made more available in places where it's not currently utilized. What is its impact? And how can it be offered as an HIV prevention tool in conjunction with condoms, behavioral education, clean needles and syringes, and other prevention tools? Okay. Any final comments from the presenters? Well, I'd like to thank you all again for a thrilling morning, and thank you. See you tomorrow after the plenary session.